You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stage Left, a bi-monthly podcast where we talk about the latest shows on Broadway and beyond. I'm your host, Rob Russo, writer, theater critic, and founder of StageLeft.nyc, and co-host and co-producer of the Fabulous Invalid podcast, also on the Broadway Podcast Network. This podcast provides a platform for millennial and Gen Z age critics and theater journalists with the goal of broadening the cultural discussion to elevate and include as many diverse perspectives as possible.
I'm dying to know what's across the road, what's behind the wall, what's around the corner, and what will it take till I find my way? Will it be today? Will it be too late? Wait till you see what's next.
Joining me this week for our first episode ever are Casey Mink, senior staff writer at Backstage, and Ayanna Priscod, theater critic and founder of Our BK Social. Welcome to Stage Left.
Yeah,
thanks for having us.
I'm so delighted that you're the guinea pigs for this new series, and really excited that we're all together to talk about three really cool shows. So looking ahead, I think as the season progresses, we'll be more up to date with like the latest shows that have opened. But because we're recording at the end of the year, beginning of the year, it's kind of a quieter moment for new openings. So we're going to dip back into the fall schedule a little and talk about three shows that were quite notable. First, we'll talk about Slave Play and then Our Dear Dead Drug Lord. And we'll finish with Jagged Little Pill. As I was thinking about putting together this episode, I picked these three because they seemed interesting to me. But also, it's funny, in reflecting on them, all three are kind of like bastions of trigger warnings, right? Like all three have become like known for having that little warning before you walk into the theater.
Or not having much to some people's dismay.
That's right. That maybe perhaps needing one, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, then let's dive right in. First play we'll talk about is Slave Play.
Oh,
I love that reaction. Oh, cool. Well, for those who don't know, this is sort of a play that's made a lot of waves. Came from off-Broadway, premiered at New York Theater Workshop downtown in the East Village back in 2018, where it was like an instant sold-out sensation. And then some intrepid producers brought it to Broadway this fall, where it opened back in October. What do you guys think?
Ouch, awful.
Awful.
And I think I'm the only theater person who thinks it's like the worst show on Broadway.
Wow. Okay, great. Well, this is why we do the podcast.
So
explain a little bit more about that.
When I go to a Broadway show or theater in general, I like to connect with something. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in this show, I didn't connect with anything. And I found Kanisha's character to be awful. The portrayal of the angry black woman stayed with her the entire 2.5 hours. I didn't know why she was angry. Do you guys know why she was angry? Like, was trying to figure that out. And that never came to be at the end. Even with her, like, 15-minute monologue, I didn't get anything fed to me. I don't know how you guys feel about that.
Right. I mean, the word that everyone uses to describe this show is provocative.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To the extent that that word has kind of lost all meaning in reference to this show, it definitely is intentionally subversive, let's say. It's meant to incite strong feelings.
Mm-hmm. But I didn't get anything out of it. I feel like even if you incite something, Jeremy Earl Harris is a brilliant writer, don't get me wrong. But I feel like this show, opposed to Daddy that I've seen, I think Daddy was phenomenal. And I think,
really?
Yeah.
I could not say if Jeremy happens to be listening to this, sorry. But
well, it's interesting. I mean, so, you know, for folks who don't know the setup of the show, right?
Right.
It's a bit of a satire. Is that the right word?
Yeah, that's the word that he uses.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, set up around this imagined form of therapy called antebellum sexual performance therapy, right?
Yes.
Where three interracial couples are in this sort of retreat. The first, it's like generally third of the play, you're witnessing them engaged in a therapy called slave play, lowercase s, lowercase p, right? And then at a certain point, that ends and it becomes sort of a session where they talk about their feelings and their experiences. And a lot is unearthed in the course of that conversation that people have called it provocative. And it's funny, you know, I in my review, I even said this, that I called it provocative when I first saw it downtown. Sure. And then upon reflection, I was like, well, what's actually provocative about this play is that we would call it provocative.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For me personally, because, right. you know, what I liked about the show, and of course I'm saying this from the perspective of a white gay mm-hmm. man who's seeing it, right? So mm-hmm. I'm bringing who I am to the piece, right? Is that, you know, as a country, we don't talk about our racial history.
Well, right.
As much as we should, which is like, right. should be all the time, because it colors every aspect of our society. And what I liked about this play is that, to me, it at least prompts a conversation mm-hmm. about things that we don't talk about.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the issue is, I mean, I remember when it did open downtown, so many of the critics, most of whom are white yes. men, cis white men, mm-hmm. all said, I love this play and I don't think we're supposed to be talking about it. And I mean, what that reflects is just who's writing about plays.
Right.
And I mean, it's all just circuitous. And I mean, whether or not you love it or loathe it, would you agree that it has sparked conversations that maybe we wouldn't otherwise be having?
I've been having these conversations all my life. I don't know if it's in particular because I'm a Black woman, but I've been having these conversations with coworkers, with right. staff that I have. So it's not something new to me in particular.
Right.
So I don't know if I was a white person seeing this play, right. how different it would be. Also, that made me extremely uncomfortable because I saw it on a day where it was predominantly a white audience.
And that's every day, by
right.
the way.
Right.
That's not a Wednesday or Thursday thing. That's every Broadway show, every yeah. single day and night. Right.
Yeah, it was just
also
the uncomfortableness of that.
Yeah.
And what they were laughing at and what they took as funny. I don't know if that's starting the conversation that I want in mm-hmm. particular.
Right. No, that's why you're on the show, and that's why, you know, that's why we're having this conversation mm-hmm. because, you know, it brings to mind in a way the 2016 election, right? How a lot mm-hmm. of white people, you know,
were shocked,
right? And a lot of Black and brown people were like, okay, welcome to the club, because this is our experience every day.
Right.
Right.
Or like when things happen, you know, something's happening at the border and people say, this is not America. It's right. like, no, I'm pretty sure this is exactly America
absolutely.
To a T.
Exactly.
And it always has been.
Right, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I was talking to a theater journalist friend of mine who we were talking about slave play, and he said that the segment of people who have most, you know, expressed their disapproval of it are Black women.
I've mm-hmm. heard that too.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. and I think Jeremy has received some criticism on mm-hmm. you know for his writing of the character of Kenesha, mm-hmm. which you referenced earlier, and this idea of the angry Black woman as a trope. Mm-hmm.
I don't
theater.
Know if he's trying to hear us though, because mm-hmm. it was a group of us who tweeted about it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like he, like, searches slave play, in particular on Twitter.
Oh, he's a self-searcher for sure.
Yeah. yeah. Because anytime myself or another Black woman who I've spoken with about mm-hmm. this show talk about the reasons why we disapprove it or feel very uncomfortable or feel offended even, I feel like he comes back with something that's not listening to us, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. as of, well, my play is good and it's made it to Broadway. We're thankful that you're a young Black man, young Black gay man who has made it to Broadway. We're grateful. But, you know, hear us out. Hear what we're saying.
Well, on that point, I mean, I do think that it is quite notable that this play is even on Broadway.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
right.
and that's something, you know, you just said, to celebrate, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And hopefully we see more and more mm-hmm. plays
yeah.
by Black writers, by young people. I mean, mm-hmm. the fact of his youth is something that I feel like has not really been talked about
Absolutely.
Enough.
Yeah.
Well, Absolutely. I don't know if it hasn't been talked about enough. I mean, I think it's definitely been talked about a lot. I also think that there is, and this will certainly factor into the other two plays that we will discuss, but I definitely think there is this narrative around young male geniuses.
Mm.
And actually, whenever I've interviewed Lee Silverman a couple times, and that's something that she brings up a lot because I always ask her, you know, things in the realm of advice for aspiring young female directors.
Mm-hmm.
And she is just very honest about the fact that there is no equivalent for women. There's this sort of, there's just this ideology around a wunderkind that works for men, which isn't to say, I do love the play. I don't think I've said it, but I do love the play. And I think Jeremy is brilliant, but I don't think he's been profiled by every single outlet
right.
on the planet, you know?
That's real.
And he had two plays in New York in the span of 6 months before he, you know, had finished matriculating at Yale. And
I mean, yeah, I think that people talk about his age quite a bit, which is amazing. I think there should be more young writers and directors. Mm-hmm. Always.
Well, you know, it calls to mind, and again, to make another political point, this is staged left, so, you know, that's a little intentional, right? But, you know, it's like in looking at political candidates, how women are judged for what they've done, and men are judged for what they promise to do, right?
Biden's not judged on either.
They completely ignore. But I guess that's another podcast. excellent. Well, I mean, to close out this segment of the show, I also loved Slave Play, and it's a critic's pick on my site, and I think the number one reason that I do really love the play is precisely because of the conversation that I think it sparks. And again, as a white person, these are conversations that I'm not used to having. And it to me unearths a lot of things that I've never thought about, particularly regarding interracial couples. You know, that's just a whole dimension of race and sex and sexuality that I had never really thought critically about. So that's something that I found in the play. But again, if you've had those conversations your whole life, then I totally understand how it might not be as shattering for you to see that reflected on stage.
So I guess it's good in that point where it's making white people think a little differently. The mirrors were very intentional.
And not that I can speak for all white people, but we need to think. And I'm glad you brought up the mirrors.
The mirrors,
Because we haven't talked about the production itself, right?
Yeah,
I
mean,
I think
it's amazing.
The design of it is...
Well, and there's Rihanna lyrics plastered above the stage, which is... I mean, she's featured prominently. I guess we've already spoiled the whole thing. The other thing I do want to say about the play, because I saw it downtown, and that was when it was still really secretive, and I walked out just in a total haze, and I completely forgot until I saw it again uptown that it's really fucking funny.
Yes.
It's very funny. I mean, obviously, you have a lot of issues with it, so you probably weren't laughing that much, but the actor character.
Yes.
Who's
James Cassady Moyer.
Yes.
Is the actor.
Thank you. He has a monologue that, especially working at Backstage, we're all about actors.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great actor's moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny too, because, you know, I did see it downtown and then seeing it on Broadway. When it translated from a New York Theater Workshop, which is really small, maybe 200 seats, to a Broadway house, the smallest or one of the smallest Broadway houses, but still, you know, by multiple sizes, times bigger. The production under the direction of Robert O'Hara, who's brilliant.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant.
Absolutely
amazing.
Brilliant. Got broader to fill the space, I felt.
And
that monologue in particular, I don't remember being as struck by it downtown as I was uptown.
Oh, yeah. He's... milking that monologue.
Oh, yes.
It's a good moment.
Yes.
I like that every character, regardless of the substance of it, has a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's a true ensemble piece in that regard.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And those mirrors. I mean, anytime you walk into a theater and you see mirrors, you know, okay, we're about to be indicted as an audience.
Well, except one of my favorite musicals, if you follow me on Twitter, first of all, I'm sorry. Second of all, you know that I love If Then. That very bad Gina Menzel musical.
That was
There were mirrors in that, and that was...
I think
that was simple.
This set design was actually the same mirrors from Three Tall Women. I could be wrong, but
it's
think
also
it's
the Golden
exact...
Theater, right?
Yeah.
They just catch
them backstage. Right? We're like, these will come in handy again.
Just the brilliance of that metaphor, because along the mezzanine is the McGregor plantation, right?
Right.
I think it's a drawing of the... Or is it a picture?
I think it's
an actual picture. I actually visited... That plantation.
Okay, so it's a real,
2 months before I saw this place, so it was like,
oh my God.
It's in New Orleans, so it's a little awkward.
Yeah, I can imagine. But
I think
the
it's
idea
like the Oak Valley plantation or something like that.
Of the audience looking forward, but not escaping the past.
Right.
And literally everywhere you look, that plantation is looking back at you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I thought that was just such a
striking...
We have
to look at our own dumb faces the whole time.
Literally. Yeah, well, that too.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Okay, alrighty. So let's move on to the second play we wanted to talk about. Which Casey, I know, is just bursting with excitement. When I asked her to come on the show, she was like, can we please talk about this?
Yeah, yeah. I really did ask to talk about this one.
So our dear dead drug lord, kick us off.
Our dear dead drug lord. So I actually missed it in its first few months of its run, and thankfully it extended and I got myself up there because there's so much. We talked about this. There's just so much to see. And you can't get to everything. But I'm so glad I ultimately did not miss this play because it's wild. It's absolutely insane. The last 15 minutes, I had my hands just like clasped to my face because it is so intense. And yeah, we were talking about trigger warnings. I mean, certainly they apply here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to like give everything away about it, but I mean, it's about smart, passionate high school girls, and we certainly don't have enough of that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. At that age.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, young girls who are, and this is the same of Jagged Little Pill, girls in high school who are engaged politically.
Mm-hmm.
That's not unusual. I was very active politically in high school. Like, I didn't turn 18. I was like, I think I'm going to figure out this voting thing. Right. Like, no, I knew what was happening.
You were ready. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was ready. Also, yeah, I cared. I got in arguments with my conservative teachers. Like, and depictions of that, I mean, across the board in the arts, film and television, but especially in theater, we do not have enough of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like in that way, this show is very much in conversation with Jagged Little Pill, but also with a show I'm a fan of called What the Constitution Means to Me.
Yes.
And I'm not going to come on a podcast and not talk about What the Constitution Means to Me.
It's a rule. We must always talk about What the Constitution Means to Me. Yeah.
Thank you. I take that compliment personally. But yeah, I mean, I feel like high school girls being smart and advocating for themselves is not uncommon. I don't understand why it's so uncommon in arts.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because your experience at the play is exactly my experience at the play, which is it was on my list of shows I wanted to see this fall.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know about you, but like September and October was just nuts this year.
Yeah,
everything opened. And I was like, what's going on? This is usually
so
in April.
Great stuff.
You know?
Yeah, no.
A lot
I
of really
like,
great
remember
stuff.
When the fall was less busy than the spring?
That was well, off-Broadway in particular.
Yes.
I feel like off-Broadway was so hot.
It was so hot. Yes.
Yeah, it was like blazingly hot in the best way. There was so much amazing stuff, but
yeah.
I couldn't see it.
But then this extended, I think, more than once.
Mm-hmm.
And then
three times.
Mm-hmm. There you go. And so I finally had a chance to see it. And I was so excited.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, it had been on my list. And I can't imagine not having seen this play now. After
oh my
seeing
God.
It, right? You know, like
my tweets alone.
I know.
Like, I've had to.
I tweeted almost immediately after seeing it that I was mad that I had done my top 10 list of 2019 before I saw it because
That's
I couldn't
so
include it because it probably would have been in my top 10.
Yeah.
But you've just touched on something that I think is so true and tragic, but also hopeful about this play, which is that, you know, it is a depiction of young teenage girls, right? And it's almost like in the past 3 to 5 years, the theater world has suddenly realized, oh, there's this like half of society called women. Maybe we should tell their stories.
Maybe this coincides with the crazy thing that happened in 2016.
Right? And then there's a portion of these women who are teenagers and younger, you know, girls, and you know, maybe they have something interesting to say.
Also, maybe they go to the theater and buy tickets.
Well, that too. Yeah.
And I feel like this play in particular was packed with so many issues, but it didn't feel overwhelming.
Yes. Mm.
There's some shows like...
Yeah.
we'll get there. We're on the same page here.
You were
subtweeting. I just feel like... Yeah, we're going to get there in a moment, but I just feel like this was constructed so well, where it didn't feel overwhelming. I had said this before the podcast had started, that a friend of mine said this was like The Craft on steroids. And I truly believe, like, after seeing like, wow, yeah, this totally is. It's beyond just connecting with the dead, but it's, there's so many issues. You guys have to see the show.
It's written by, I mean, a young woman, Alexis Scheer, directed by a young woman, Whitney White. Yeah, I mean, it's just a, it's voices that we have not seen on stage before, and it's just, you see something like this that is so finely crafted and also thrilling and exhilarating and fun. And you just wonder, like, why are we waiting so long to make this commonplace? Why is every single teen musical about a sad, white straight boy.
Ouch.
Well, I mean, like, the coming of age of boys is, like, so mythologized, right? It's like the backbone of our media, right?
And I'm so tired of it. I like Dear Evan Hansen like everyone else. I'm so tired of musicals being crafted around a boy who is sad.
Lame.
Also, and why are shows like this still just off-Broadway? Like, we need to bring it to broader audiences.
As I reflect on the last years of my theater going, the show, I mean, a lot of the shows that pop out are shows like Sarah Dillaps' The Wolves, or Claire Barron's Dance Nation.
Oh my God, both of those.
Or Aziza Barnes' Blacks, which is at MCC Theater.
Yeah,
right?
Listen, Blacks needs to be a Netflix series.
Oh, yes. Like, that's what I wrote in my review.
It just needs to be a series.
I want to live with those girls, right?
Why didn't that transfer? Why didn't that move? I mean, we know the logistical reasons why it didn't.
But yeah,
truly, tell me why that's not getting buoyed and moved to a bigger audience.
I don't know. Paging producers, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, well, and that's also, who are the producers? Most of them are white men, and they bring the stories that they want to see to Broadway. We get a Millionth Mammoth revival starring whatever.
Or another jukebox musical.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, audiences are ready for it. Clearly, we're ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, this play, you know, extended three times, has run over 100 performances. Which is a huge feat
for an off-Broadway show. Many Broadway shows closed before then.
That's right.
Huge feat for an off-Broadway show.
I mean, it was a moment to celebrate. When I saw the news story, I was like, yes, wow, how incredible.
Shout out to publicist extraordinaire Nicole Capitasto, who Matt Ross PR took over the show actually like halfway through the run because it extended so much and they got on board and were like, no, we're gonna shower this show and make it a thing, and they totally have.
Oh my gosh. I just absolutely loved it. Unfortunately, it will have closed by the time this airs. Which is sad. But maybe it'll extend again.
Maybe somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a piece that would be primed to be done in regional theaters around the country. Right? I mean, I don't know if a tour is possible, but like, you know, I could imagine a lot of theaters wanting to see something like this.
Yeah, and also just a cast of, you know, what is it, five women? That's easy.
Yeah, I mean, everybody
but
wants
But I love them play. In particular.
Yes.
These women were all of phenomenal.
All of them are fresh out of college.
It's crazy.
Wow. Most of their New York debuts.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Nuts.
Yeah, no, I was blown away by their performances.
Yeah, for sure.
So naturalistic.
And, you know, and the play, for those who didn't get a chance to see it, you know, is set in a treehouse.
Yeah.
Where these girls are meeting for their school sanctioned club, the Dead Leaders Club.
Right.
Where they each semester or each year they pay tribute or study up on a different dead leader. And the current leader of the group. The current leader of the group has decided that Pablo Escobar is going to be the leader that they profile, So that alone, that setup alone,
It's and then perfect.
Set design, first of all, is phenomenal for a small theater. They used every inch of the stage, and it was completely phenomenal. You felt like you were in Miami. You felt like you were in a treehouse. It was phenomenal.
Well, so and WP Theater, Women's Project Theater, right?
I mean, this is
their 41st season of, you know.
So vital. But then it's like, okay, again, most people, you know, the average, even the average theater goer doesn't really know anything about WP Theater. And it's like, because it doesn't get the
praise and attention that it should, because it's about and by women. Wow,
yeah.
Shocking.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I started this podcast, right?
Is
so that we can
so good.
Be another platform Thank to you, try Rob. To like, you know, boo, I'm not looking for praise, but like, you know, just to boo.
Takes a white man.
It does, right? Yeah. But just to buoy these, you know, groups, you know, companies that people might not know about or shows like this that are kind of under the radar unless you're really tuned into, you know, what's going on in New York.
And shout out to the Kilroys in that vein, which every year, do you know the Kilroys?
No, I don't know the Kilroys.
You know the Kilroys?
No.
Oh my God.
You guys don't educate us, please.
The Kilroys is an organization that every year releases, basically they scout emerging female playwrights or
that's amazing.
Female playwrights, women identifying playwrights, gender non-binary, basically any non-cis male playwright. And a lot of those playwrights go on to, you know, be produced, and it's just a way to magnify these voices that unfortunately struggle to get traction, more so than the millionth Arthur Miller production we're going to do this year.
It's so real. Well, I mean, and
it's Tennessee Williams.
It's a testament to the fact that, like, unfortunately, in order to change the existing, like, structure of the way the world is, we have to be intentional about making that change. We can't just sit back and say, oh, you know, let it happen, because it won't happen, because that's why it doesn't happen, right? I mean, you need a group like the Kilroys.
This is why, like, I know I'm so insufferable on Twitter. Oh my God. But
no, we love you on Twitter, Casey.
Right? No.
Please.
I mean, it's hot Twitter feed. But like, at least I use it because I need to call out the millionth male written, directed, composed musical of the season. It's just it fucking pisses me off.
Shout out to Hadestown.
Shout out to Hadestown. Thank you. The first musical to ever win Best Musical Tony Award that's written and directed by women.
By a woman.
2019.
There
it
we
took
go.
Till 2019.
That's crazy.
Well, perfect segue to the third show that we're going to talk about, which is written, directed, and music by women. And that is Jagged Little Pill. There's a lot that I like about this show, I have to admit. My review was sort of like, you know, it's like the hardest type of review to write, which is the mixed review. Because there was a lot that I took issue with or was sort of like confounded with, not like in an angry, just in a like, really? Kind of way about this show. But what I loved about this show, I will say, is precisely what we've talked about now multiple times, right? Which is that it is a story that is anchored by women. There are men, and there are, you know, there's a ton of plot lines in this show.
Right.
And the men have their plot lines, but kind of who cares, right?
So, yeah.
Because 100%. The most interesting stories in this musical are, and there's multiple ones, but I would say Mary Jane, the mother, who's dealing with drug addiction. Frankie, the daughter, who's dealing with her own sort of, you know, personal, political, racial, and sexual awakening, and sort of figuring all that out as an adopted daughter in a white family, and she's African-American. Yeah. And then the character of Bella, who is a victim, of not a victim, but a survivor, I should correct myself, of sexual assault. And to put a fine point on it, rape. And to see those stories intersecting on stage in a Broadway, in a big budget, highly anticipated Broadway musical, is, I mean, it shouldn't be revelatory, but it is, but because it is. When do you see that, right? So that's, I mean, top line, what I liked about this show.
Yeah, it's about, what it's really about is female rage, which, I mean, again, like what the Constitution means to me, but it's so infuriating having to go through life every day as a woman, just on a myopic scale and on a much broader scale, I mean, politically or just on the train when someone looks at you for way too goddamn long. Like, it's just so infuriating being a woman. I'm sure you feel that way.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, where are the depictions of female rage, of women's rage in our theater?
I just liked the subtle notes that this show portrayed, i.e., I think in the first scene, I'm sorry, what's the young girl's name again?
Frankie.
She had on shorts. And as a black woman with these shorts, it's different from when a white woman, and I feel like black women have been talking about clothes for the longest, but she had on these American Eagle shorts. And if a white woman was were to have on those shorts, it would be different on how a white person would take the outfit. So her mom is telling her, you don't need to be wearing those shorts. And she's like, it's my body. Mm-hmm. I have curves. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. Yeah. But they're just subtle moments in the show that I was like, oh, my God, this is not on a Broadway stage. Yeah. Especially at the end, the sign that said Believe Black Women. I was like, oh, my God, this is not on a Broadway stage like at all for whatever. The house has how many seats for them to see this?
It's, over 1,000 probably.
Yeah.
Right?
I think it's like 1,200 or something. Yeah.
But there were just little subtle moments. I do believe that the show is overpacked with stuff.
that's another statement.
Yeah, it's like so much going on. I felt overwhelmed.
Yeah.
But there were subtle moments that I was like, wow,
yeah,
this is crazy.
I mean, I was just going to say, I think it definitely could have used one or two more out-of-town tryouts. Yeah. Whittled that down a little bit, but I totally agree with everything that you said, for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's, you know, it's a testament to Diabla Cody, the writer, who, if you know that name, it's from, you know, writing Juno, but she's, of course, written a bunch of other great works. And, you know, I think the team who had the idea of taking Jagged Little Pill and the Alanis Morissette songbook and making a musical should be commended for...
Yeah.
Not saying, okay, well, we'll do the Alanis Morissette bio musical.
I'm or so glad.
We'll find some movie or some play and we'll stick these songs into it and we'll shoehorn them in some way. Mm-hmm. They decided to come up with an original story that is in conversation with what's happening now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I will say, I mean, obviously the score is not original, but original stories, period, on Broadway, not nearly enough.
Yeah, we get like one a season.
We get about one a season.
You know,
that
literally.
That doesn't have source material.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone talks about the 2018 season. It was, you know, the SpongeBob Frozen Mean Girls season where everyone's like, oh, wow, we are we're out of ideas.
Right, yeah.
And even The Band's Visit, which was like the show, the critical darling that year, was based on a film.
A film,
And I think it's always a good thing when original stories are being produced.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when they're by women. And Diabla Cody's an amazing writer.
Yeah. I mean, so to put on my grouch hat about this show.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely imperfect.
Yeah, I mean, what I struggle with is, I mean, I called it a moving mood board in my review because, like, you know, there were so many ideas thrown up, right? And a lot of them so valid and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, as you're going through the course of the show, there's just, like, conceptual whiplash happening because, you know, you're having this, like, very, like, grounded book scene that has these notes of truth and reality in them that are really exciting. And then suddenly there's this, like, ensemble of, like, hipster Brooklyn people who emerge who are doing this, like, very abstract modern dance. And you're like, what is happening?
I really commend the show for doing a lot of, just doing a lot.
Right, doing a lot.
And I think a lot of, most of the performances are stellar. Catherine Gallagher.
Yes, as Bella.
As Bella, and Elizabeth Stanley plays the mother. Mm-hmm. But I just think it's really, really hard to do a musical about such serious subjects. It just, at times, almost felt a little silly.
Yeah.
And that's not what you want when
especially when you're
doing a show about assault and addiction. You know,
and addiction.
I did think the assault through line was very delicately sort of woven until we got to that scene with the protest and like that original song, that which is one of two original songs Alanis wrote for the show.
Yes.
And it's just like has no subtlety.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
And it's also just, I mean, again, just sort of circling back to the trigger warning thing. It's not truthful to the way that assaults are typically handled. I mean, as like for survivors of assault, what you wouldn't want is a protest in your name where everyone's chanting your name because you came forward about something and they didn't believe you. And also those cases usually don't turn out well for the woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I just didn't love that.
Yeah, I was following up to that point, and I was like, oh, why did we go here?
But again, I mean, we're talking about it.
Yes.
And it's a Broadway musical that depicts a high school assault, I mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
I did love CD's choreography. I thought it was phenomenal. The reverse dancing.
Yeah,
like,
that was crazy.
Yeah, that
sequence. She pulls the trash bag.
Yeah, like, it was like, whoa, how did you do that? And to do that every night is amazing to me. But it also brings me back to a show that was like this, that used Tupac's music, A Rose That Grew From Concrete.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, how did that not work? But this kind of works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm a little confused that, like, the jukebox musical of what do we want? Do we want, like, an original story with a jukebox musical, or do we want,
and this show, like, for the record, is making bank. It's doing really well.
Well, Alanis Morissette's music.
Exactly. Right. So maybe, I mean, maybe we just start there. We find the best music. I mean, like, the Tina Turner musical's on Broadway right now, and that book isn't particularly...
It's not good at all.
But Tina Turner's music is so
timeless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's so fire that you walk out of there and you're like, that was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even frankly care about whatever story. I mean,
I mean, so I think fans of the Alanis Morissette songbook, of which I consider myself one, will revel in the opportunity to hear these songs so well sung, so well
orchestrated.
Tom Kidd is a genius.
Mm-hmm. Literally Tom Kidd.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, how does he do all the things he does, A?
Right.
He's, like, involved in every musical.
He wrote the Idina Menzel. Oh, my God. I just hit all of my parts. Right?
You've done it. You've done it.
I have to talk about Katrina Lenk, and then we're done.
You just did. You brought it up.
Okay. I have to talk about Phantom Visit. Oh, God.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I think that the music aspect of it is tremendous. Where I fault the show is that I think sometimes the music is because it is so good, reaches dramatic heights that, like, the story or the scenes
don't match.
Mm. Right? In particular, You Ought to Know, which is, like, the ultimate rage anthem.
Yes.
And it arrives in a point in the show where, like, the stakes to me were just so low. Or non-existent.
Like, liminal character. I mean, she's great. What is her name? Lauren
Joe.
Patton.
Yeah, so she's Joe is the character in Lauren Patton.
Incredible. And she, the night I was there, which I'm sure was true for you too, she got a mid-performance
standing ovation. Yes.
Because everyone just loves that song so much, and she sings it beautifully.
Right.
But I don't really know why she sang it.
Yeah, I mean.
It's kind of no purpose because her mom made her wear a sweater
to church.
That scene
was very empty,
though. I mean, like, spoiler alert, the rage that brings on this song, which is so epic, is that, like, her kind of girlfriend slept with a boy once that she's known for, like, a week.
And ran away.
And it's like, okay, well, great. But, like...
Right. I mean, I'd be pissed, too.
Right, but sure. Like, but does that reach the level?
And they try and flesh out her character by saying, you know, that her mom is a homophobe.
Right.
And she made her wear that little sweater.
Yeah, right.
But it's ultimately because... it's trying to do so much.
Right.
They are not.
There's
not enough time to flesh out that character, and therefore that moment I felt like was kind of hollow.
Yes.
Yeah. And in the minority, I didn't stand up.
Casey, I didn't stand up either. And I called it hollow in my review.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it felt so unearned.
But again, Lauren Patton, amazing.
Oh, she's
amazing.
Phenomenal. She's phenomenal. Mm-hmm, but truly. She's just trapped in a moment that doesn't work. But also that moment was another example of the conceptual whiplash. Suddenly it becomes a concert. Right. Quite literally.
Yeah.
Like, concert lights lower.
So
the band moves on stage.
And
you're like, where are we? I thought we were on a New York City stage.
I didn't understand that. I like when bands are on stage, but the moments that they came in was...
Right. Mood board.
Yeah, I was just like,
it's just fan service.
Yes.
And sometimes you got to do that. But that's... I feel like this musical has really tried to position itself as a salient story.
Right.
And that is... That moment, I think, really sort of epitomizes my... not issues with it, just why I'm not crazy about it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I liked it. I had a fun time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same. I will say, after being a little confounded the whole way through, in the end, I was, like, very moved. And I couldn't locate where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, they sat down on that couch to bookend the show, and I was like, oh, I've been through a dream.
That was the moment.
Yes.
I know. There were people crying around me. I didn't understand why. Yeah. There were certain moments, but...
Yeah. I think Elizabeth Stanley also is doing amazing work.
Yes.
In someone else's hands, that role would have been ridiculous.
100%. Mm-hmm. And if she doesn't get a Tony nomination, then...
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's got it. I already have my...
I will have my protest
Tony nomination.
Outside the Tonys.
No, she's going to be in that five. Don't worry.
Yeah, for sure. Ooh.
I'll tell you all.
Yeah, there's some eyebrows over there. Amazing. Well, I think... that point, we should wrap up our conversation. Thank you guys so much for joining me for this first episode.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone for listening. Can you each share with our audience how folks can find you and your work online?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, as I've mentioned way too many times already, I'm pretty active on Twitter. That's Casey_Mink, and I share most of my stories that I feel like sharing on there. But you can also find all of my work at backstage.com.
You can find me on Twitter at Ayanna P, AYANNAP, or OurBKSocial.com.
Fabulous. Great. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much.
Just behind the wall, just around the corner, a new bit of history there, right? Something you all might underestimate. But wait till you see what's next, just behind.
Stage Left, the podcast, is a co-production of The Fabulous Invalid LLC and O&M Etc., and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode was sound engineered by Dori Berenstein. You can find this podcast online at stageleft.nyc, on the Broadway Podcast Network website, on iTunes, and wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can read my archive of reviews at stageleft.nyc, and you can find me on Twitter at stageleft_NYC. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll tune in next time.
Till you see what's next.
Just across the road, just around the corner.
Wait till you see what's next.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.